It's time now for All You Ever Wanted to Know, a chance for you to get to know what's going on in and around your community and the fabulous people that make it happen. With On the Land, here's Jack Dawes.
Well, good morning. On the Land today is coming to you from Regina. We're here on South Albert in Regina, down Hotel Strip there. A lot of people would know it, south of the legislature. The commercial strip here, it's the now called the Royal Executive Hotel. I can't recall what it used to be called, but the reason we're here is a group that for many of us kind of popped out of the woodwork last week, calling themselves Comtrack Logistics Solutions, are holding the first of a dozen producer meetings to discuss a terminal project with a difference. We've gone through the area of farmer ownership and terminals, and this group, this farmer group that organized this meeting and our contracts, they said they started out with 25 or 30. They narrowed it down to a steering committee of 7 or 8, and by the way, are looking for other partners in that. And they have proposed an interesting terminal concept, which we're going to talk more about here on the program today. They say the big key will be it will be diverse, not just grain and not just wheat and canola, but everything that's, if you look at it, they have drawn a 180-kilometer wide circle around Weyburn, let's say, south of Regina. And the northern tip of that, if you can imagine, it would be about Yorkton, and then the southern tip, of course, would stretch down into the U.S. There's a huge amount of grain grown in that area, but they're also planning to create this terminal structure capable of handling petroleum, what they call aggregates, other commodities as well. So we're going to let you hear from one of the proponents on the program today, maybe several if we're lucky. The meeting is still underway, and we've broken away. But the group of contracts enlisted Kevin Hirsch, well-known broadcaster and farmer, who is also, by the way, the exec director for ITAC. That's a inland terminal group in Canada, of which there still are 5 independent terminal members. Here to talk about the history of the terminal movement and what the potential might be for the future. So this was pre-recorded with Kevin Hirsch on his take on, let's say, how we got here from there. All right, with Kevin Hirsch. Kevin, first of all, in regards to the contracts sessions, now, are you at this point a shareholder, or are you presenting on their behalf? What's your context?
Yeah, I'm not involved with the proposal at all. They've contacted me and asked me to speak at the first 4 of their sessions and talk a little bit about the history of farmer ownership and grain handling, and like you, a longtime observer of the grain industry and grain industry ownership. And I'm also serve as executive director of Inland Terminal Association, so I see it from that perspective. So I can't comment specifically on Comtrax's proposal and the merits therewith, but can give a little bit of background as to where we find ourselves at this particular juncture.
Well, maybe put your farmer hat on for a second, Kevin. Now, do you see that farmers will be interested in this kind of offering?
Well, I hope they are. I hope they give it a thorough hearing. It's amazing. Sometimes it's in history has shown that you're more likely to get farmer investment when farmers really don't have much money to invest because times are tough and they're looking for solutions. We've come through some relatively pretty good years in grain agriculture for most producers in most areas. So there should be some cash available to make some off-farm investments, but, you know, producers will have to look at the proposal and decide if it's something they want to be involved in. Certainly the history of farmer ownership or investment in the grain handling industry, we're probably at an all-time low in our lifetimes, Jack, as far as where it's come, and maybe this would be the beginning of the trend edging back the other way.
All right, then, given that we've come through, yeah, let's say, an era, a couple of decades of farmers investing in terminals, recently that that has changed. What do you see as the what do you see as the pluses in what the contracts proposal is right now?
Well, most of the, you know, if we go back to the farmer-owned terminals, per se, you know, previous history to that, we had, you know, the three Prairie Wheat Pools, United Grain Growers, and then Agricore United, and then Viterra bought out Agricore United, and then Glencore bought out Viterra, or owns Viterra. So that whole cooperative grain handling movement that dominated prairie agriculture at one point is now in the history books. Within the farmer-owned terminals, we've seen a whole bunch of those sold in the last number of years. You know, Northeast Terminal at Wadena was sold, Lethbridge Inland Terminal, Prairie West Terminal, Great Sandhills Terminal, and the granddaddy of them all, Weyburn Inland Terminal, was sold to Parrish and Heimbecker back in 2014. But it wasn't because those terminals were doing poorly. In most cases, those farmers sold their investment or voted to sell their investment for a number of reasons. One is that the returns were very good, many multiples of their original investment. And some of them were in retirement age. Some of them hadn't retired already. They were looking to cash out. I think there was some uncertainty in the post-CWB era as to how the world would unfold. And there were many buyers looking to expand their network. So there were ready buyers. But if you look at the history of it, I'm involved as a small shareholder in Southwest Terminal the main terminal is near Gull Lake, but they've also got farm input facilities at many locations now. That was way back in the mid-90s that that proposal was put forward. I think the elevator there opened in 1997. The original share price was $100 per share. Their book value on that is now, I think, $1,300. They're actually trading value. Shares are trading at around $1,300, and their book value, since it's $1,950 for that $100 share. Now, they were involved in a number of things, including farm input sales that this contract proposal doesn't seem to include. But the history of farmer-owned terminals has been that it has, in the past, been a pretty darn good investment and also gives producers some say and some insight into the grain handling system. So I guess I'm an advocate of farmer ownership, but everybody has to make their own decisions as to whether or not this proposal works for them.
All right, so you're connected with terminal owners through ITAC. Do you think some of the commercial companies are interested in this kind of partnership, if I can use that term, with farmers?
Well, I think you see all of the main players expanding in their own right, and there's been all sorts of announcements with existing players and even some new players. The G3 terminals that are come out of the CWB, but also some new players like Grange Connect, but also the other major players also looking to expand their network. So I think there probably would be a fair bit of commercial interest in a proposal that made sense. And in some of the five existing farmer-owned inland terminals that are at least 50% farmer-owned, three of those have very significant investment by the larger players. So I would suspect that a well-put-together proposal, there would be a number of commercial interests that would be looking at that and may be interested pending the opportunity that they could see.
Just for clarity, what are the three you're suggesting there, Kevin?
Sorry, Jack, I'm not following you.
Oh, sorry, you mentioned there were three, commercial entities with significant farmer interest or connections.
Yes,
I hear you
yes,
right there.
Yes, you bet. Yeah. Gardiner Dam Terminal in the Loreburn area and CMI Terminal at Macomb are both 50-50 joint ventures with Viterra. Now, both of those entities own their own farm input supply business entirely, but the grain side are 50-50 joint ventures with Viterra. And in the case of Southwest Terminal, Cargill is a minority shareholder, but a significant shareholder. And there is an agreement between the entities there. So So those two do have, do have involvement. If you look back further, Lethbridge Inland Terminal was purchased by Viterra. Northeast Terminal was purchased by Cargill. There seems to be these assets are certainly sought after, and handling capacity continues to increase in the Prairie region as we look to be growing bigger crops and a wider diversity of crops. Our grain handling system continues to adapt, and of course, new technology where you can load a lot of cars in a short period of time is where the industry is at now. And the newest innovation is loop tracks, where you don't have to unhook any of the cars, and you can just keep the cars moving slowly ahead and load a large number of cars in a short time. It just aids in efficiency of the system.
Well, Kevin, on the question of loop tracks, and all right, not far away from the Weyburn area, the Northgate project that's been underway now, I guess, for a couple of years, is that the type of thing that the contracts project would be about?
That's my understanding. And similar to Northgate, as I understand the contracts proposal, it isn't just about grains, oilseeds, and pulse crops, although that's a major part of it, along with cleaning capacity for those crops. But they're also, that Weyburn and Southeast region has also got lots of crude oil that needs to move by rail. And there's other things such as aggregate and fertilizer and other commodities that they also think that they would be in good position to load. And the Sioux line going down into the States is the one they're looking at. So you can go east, west, or south, and also very good highway connections there. So makes that region a logical place for what they're trying to accomplish.
So that, again, is broadcaster and farmer Kevin Hirsch, who was hired by Comtrax Logistics Solutions, a group of farmers and others interested in developing a multi-purpose terminal, probably in the Weyburn area on a Sioux line track. Now, Mark Brathrude and his comments this morning talked a lot about the importance of this proposed terminal being diversified. They would intend to handle virtually every commodity, since now it used to be just canola and wheat, of course, and canola has grown mightily in this area. But there's also chickpeas, winter wheat, winter cereals, of course, and many other commodities being grown in the specialty crop area. And by the way, Kevin Hirsch is a specialty crop producer and part of that industry, and we're going to hear more from him on that side of it. Now, one of the great potentials the organizers feel for this Comtrax project is in the area of oil and heavy oil, petroleum. And this is some raw recording from one of the participants, one of the steering committee, who apparently farms and also has interest and experience in the oil industry, Dan Cugnet. This was some of the his discussion with about, I'm guessing, 35 to 40 people in the room at this first of this series of public information meetings.
Crude, of course, top of the ladder. Aggregate, we've got gravel, sand, ballast, frac sand. When we look at a 20 project for the highway here from Regina to Portal, that's a lot of material, a lot of fill, let alone pipe, pump jacks, precast cement components. I think of SVI, did this whole project for the stadium here in Regina. Scrap metal, fertilizer, obviously, something that we're going to continue to need in agriculture, chemicals. And then the other diversification opportunities, milling past as specialty flours, so on. And the list goes on. There's a lot of potential out there. So, we look at primarily crude, which is, of course, a huge play in southeast Saskatchewan here. We have a lot of crude here. It's not going away. There's a misconception out there that the world does not need oil and gas and is quickly adjusting to different sources of energy. Nothing could be farther from the truth. While investment and push into renewables is definitely occurring, what's lost in the noise created by all of this is the actual trajectory of global consumption. As you can see here on the graph, You can almost sit your watch, the global consumption going up 1 million barrels a day each year, right? So, you know, in 2008, we had the financial crisis, things dipped down, and that's basically, you know, the route that we're going. So, you know, globally, we do consume about 1 million barrels a day more each year, year in, year out. Current projections have that capping out at 108 to 112 million barrels a day. And the jury's out on whether we actually hit that point or not, but we're projected to get there by 2030. So I wouldn't pretend to guess. And when I look at this, you know, is that going to be the wall that we hit? Perhaps. But it's worth noting that no one says it will be going backwards from that potential peak oil consumption point, just that we may flatline there. And a huge amount of those barrels are going to be coming out of the oil sands in northern Alberta as we get into this show. We'll see how we are increasing. So a big part of the play crude by rail has to do with the differential. And I don't know if it's something, the word that people have heard, or if they get it or they understand it. But the differential is what makes crude by rail such an attractive and lucrative opportunity in the market. It's most easily defined as a difference in the gravity or the weight of oil and the difference in the price as a result of that, right? We're producing a lot of light oil in southeast Saskatchewan. You hear heavy oil, you know, they call it tar sands or whatever, the oil sands projects. So this difference can be created in attitude by a multitude of variables and layers, like type of oil, location, number of connections pipeline-wise, distance to get to market, supply, demand, pipeline capacity, refinery needs. That differential is constantly moving in flux, like on a daily basis. And it can widen out, depending on these variables, very quickly to different numbers. So I'm going to reference and quote from an oil and gas bulletin article from April 25th, 2013, that really explains this well and just how volatile it can be. And it also gives good context to how quickly you know, things change and the opportunities that are presented by it. So I quote here, last year the rail rush was driven by limited pipeline capacity and the wide gap between the price for U.S. oil and the price for Canadian oil. The difference between the two, or the difference in oil price between any two places, is that differential. There were some big differentials at Christmas 2012. Canadian light oil traded as low as $68 a barrel and heavy oil at $48 a barrel. At the same time, refiners on the U.S. Gulf Coast and Northeast were paying overseas price for their heavy oil feedstock at $110 a barrel. That's the discount that we get handled with here.
So that again was Dan Cugnet, one of the steering committee on an entity known as Comtrax, a basically farmer-driven group seeking to establish a, let's say, a new generation multi-purpose terminal in the Weyburn area. I'm with about 35 or 40 people that are attending the first of a series of public meetings today in Regina on the land coming live from here. We're hoping that as the meeting breaks up in the next little while, that we may be able to grab another one of the principals and talk more about this interesting project with one or more of them. We're also going to talk more about transportation, so stay with us. It's On the Land from the Rock. I'm Jack Doz.
You're listening to All You Ever Wanted to Know. If you have a question for today's guest, call 783-5160 or 1-855-449-5160.
On the Land is coming to you from Regina at the Royal Executive Hotel. It's the first of a series of information meetings, discussion on a new terminal concept. You just heard from Dan Cugnet a couple of minutes ago, who is a farmer and also has some background in the oil industry. Dan has joined me now directly from the meeting. Dan, if you would, first of all, just tell me about your farming operation.
I farm and ranch with my three brothers and my mother in the Weyburn area, and we're a mixed operation, so we're half cattle, half grain.
And where does petroleum fit into your portfolio?
Well, my father started a private company in the 70s called Valley Petroleums, and then as well went on to be a director with companies like Crescent Point, Mission, Star Point. So we've got a small family oil company, and then we're also involved in different oil field service companies in the sector, drilling rigs, service rigs, and so on. So,
I wonder if I can ask you in that case now, you're here basically talking to farmers as the idea, but do you see potential that people in the petroleum industry and maybe the rail industry will be interested in partnering or investing in this project?
That's our hope, and that's our belief, that we feel like there's a lot of opportunity for oil and gas companies to get their product on the tracks, just as well as from a farmer standpoint. And hopefully we'll see some investment from that sector, and definitely interest. The companies that we've talked to and individuals have expressed interest. So,
Danny, I realize you're not the guy that was, I think, that was doing the financial projections and so forth, but if I'm recalling just from the meeting, the suggestion is that a farmer that might want to consider this might want to consider an investment of one bushel per acre over a five-year period. Is that the general idea?
Well, just to break down, when we identified, we thought the producer investment would be in about the $30 million range. You know, rather than writing a check for $50,000 or $100,000 or $400,000, which is kind of hard for us to get our head wrapped around sometimes, when we looked at this and said, you know what, if we have 600,000 acres engaged, if every one of those 600,000 acres invested one bushel an acre over 5 years, you know, if we just use a number of 10 bucks a bushel on average, that's $30 million. So it was really a way for us to break it down and, you know, try to engage a very broad and large producer base, but just to show that, you know, that this doesn't need to be a significant investment right now, and it could be done over time. And that's what we're looking at trying to stage out and create is opportunities like that. So
there's a potential of 50 to 75 million, I think was the numbers used for this terminal. And so you feel that 30 million could come from producer input.
Yes, that's our plan and our hope right now, and then we feel that the rest will be through our commercial partners with as grain entities, or perhaps crude, or maybe even an investment by the railroad themselves. You know, something like this should greatly increase their efficiencies and add value. So that's just what we're approaching with everyone that we're talking to about this, is how does this create a return on your investment and create your efficiencies or increase your efficiencies. So that's the hope.
At this point, is it possible for you to gauge interest by some of the commercial companies?
Well, we had met with some last winter, and there was significant interest from them. But, of course, it's a bit of the chicken and the egg, you know, which comes first. And for them, they need to have a sense of how many acres they can procure from and how many producers are engaged in the process. So that's why we're going out now at this point, and then get some feedback from everybody and see what they think, and then go back to those commercial entities and hopefully create partnerships.
We talked about grain and petroleum, but there's also mention of fertilizer and other aggregates. What would you consider the term of aggregate?
Well, you know, when I just think of sand, you know, gravel, rock, ballast, anything like that, when we look at this highway twinning project that's proposed from Regina to Portal to the border, you know, that's a significant amount of material, even just on a smaller scale. When I think of the operations of an RM on a daily basis, it depends on where you are, but I can just speak for, you know, our area, Weyburn. I know our gravel for our roads is getting sourced 60, 70 kilometers away, and every year that gets a little farther. You know, as it gets farther, that cost goes up. So you know, we're not going to stop using these things at present, and certainly not in the future. So, just trying to create more opportunities, right?
So, again, On the Land is coming to you from Regina today, where we're at a meeting to discuss a Comtrax logistics solution group. And I've been talking with Dan Cugnet from the farming and oil side. Mr. Brotroot, are you going to join us here for a minute? Sure. Great. Thank you very much. I've got Mark Brotroot with me now. And Mark, you can correct me on the pronunciation. That's not correct. Listeners who were with us on this program last week heard an interview with Mark where he first outlined the Comtrax idea. And we've just... since you just joined us, Mark, I was discussing that with Mr. Cugnet. How do you feel about the turnout? And I don't know if you can gauge any response here today so far.
We're happy with the turnout. Regina is certainly kind of an outlier for the target area that we're looking at. So we met our expectations, and we got lots of representation from the farming community and some and financial advisors as well, which will be helping their clients, I guess, make some decisions going forward. So that's, so we're pleased, and this is the start of an adventure, I guess.
Well, it sounds like you and your group have been adventuring for a little while now. I think my question was partly answered with the previous guest, but do you see potential, for example, aspects of the transportation industry, such as railways, maybe trucking companies or whatnot, would be partners or could be in this venture?
Yes, for sure. Particularly the railway. There's demand for this type of thing. Multi-commodity hubs seem to be maybe the way of the future or something that is developing. And I mean, if you look at more developed economies or cities, some of these rail yards and stuff have been there, and you know, and it's just we think an evolution of economies growing and rural Saskatchewan growing, I guess, in this case. And so, you know, the railway is certainly interested in our project. There are some certain things that we can offer them, and so, you know, absolutely there'll be some partnerships, and then as well as trucking companies as well. I think there's a good fit for them to fit us into their logistics line, and so again, I think we can't overstate the fact that we're open for business, and we're looking to forge as many relationships as possible.
So we're just about at the end of 2017. You got kind of a timeline ahead. You talked a bit about what comes next. Can you discuss that?
We have some short-term goals as far as the feasibility fund raise. We've done all we can as a group without spending a lot of money. We have a lot of internal expertise that has saved us some dollars, but we now need to raise a few dollars to go forward. But we think that once we get into the final stages of the feasibility study, it'll go quite quickly because of the work that we've done. It'll be more just making sure that experts in the industries and financial experts agree with what we're saying, and then we'll be able to take it to the next level. So, I mean, I don't want to be overly ambitious here, but ideally we would be hopefully starting a project in the summer. But, you know, that timeline might be a little bit tight. So, hopefully, you know, at the absolute latest, we'd be starting in 2018.
Are you talking about actually like breaking ground?
Yeah, the construction side of it. The resources are there, and the possibility is to potentially start by this summer or summer of 2017.
Which 2017.
Yeah, and then in that case, it would create opening of the facility by late 2018. But that might be a little bit. Our timeline might not quite get us there, but we're hoping we can move things along here fairly quick. And if in fact they are going to proceed.
This is the first of a series of public meetings. So is there a website or someplace where people can go to get information about upcoming meetings?
Yes, for sure. www.comtrax.ca. So www.comtrax.ca. Is the website. It's pretty basic right at the moment, but it does have that meeting information there. And, it's open for everybody. The same as we said in our meeting here, we can't emphasize enough that we want this project to be for all producers that want to be involved. So come out to the meeting and see what we got to say.
I did notice in one of the charts you put up, as far as that you drew a circle and thought could be your area of influence, Yorkton, I guess, would be just sort of on the north top side of that that circle.
Yeah,
you can put it in those geographic terms.
Yeah, certainly Yorkton's on the outside of it. But you know, like we said in the meeting,
this is an opportunity for all farmer investors, whether, you know, and if you can't envision yourself hauling to this facility yourself, it still is an opportunity to be involved in something that can have influence in the market. It could, you know, have, far-reaching results as far as Yorkton, just by some of the services that we can offer may force some of the other companies to offer those same services themselves.
Just one more thing, and I'll let you go. You mentioned you have a steering committee, but you're still interested in some more bodies?
Yes. Yeah, for sure. We will be seeking out going into the next stage. We want to add at least 4 or 5 producers to our working group and broaden our geographical base, basically just to give some of these other areas that we think are going to be good supporters a voice in our group to make sure that everybody's being heard.
Great. Well, let's get back. Thanks very much for joining us. Mark Brockford. We're live from Regina today on the land from the Rock. Mark Brockford, one of a group of farmers and other interested people from the Weyburn area, proposing a multi-purpose type of terminal transportation hub facility, as you will. We're going to talk more about transportation on the land with a consultant, Mary Jane Bennett, who has some opinions on the shape of our current system. I'm Jack Dawes on the land.
You're listening to All You Ever Wanted to Know. If you have a question for today's guest, call 783-5160 or 1-855-449-5160.
Well, a transportation consultant and industry watcher thinks there are a number of good reasons for new projects, such as the recently established multi-use terminal at Northgate and the proposed contracts concept we've been talking about here on the program today. And now, being those are on lines close to and looped into U.S. rail networks, we asked Mary Jane Bennett about the contrast between the Canadian and U.S. system. Ms. Bennett is a transportation consultant and a lawyer. She says the U.S. rail system continues to attract investment and produces improved results because it's more competitive. By contrast, Bennett says, Canada seems to be ever-evolving more disincentive regulations.
The competitive advantage that the United States holds over Canada is that their grain handling system is a market-based system, whereas Canada operates by way of regulation. The regulation is sorely out of date in terms of a new commercial non-Canadian wheat board system. So there's a lag between what the farmers can deliver and how fast it can get to export position and to market. And the advantages of the U.S. system are multiple. There is, for one thing, primarily, the biggest difference is that in the United States there's a real incentive for railroads to invest, so to add capacity so they can ship faster with fewer traffic jams. And in that regard, I note that BNSF alone, who operates along the top northern tier and is heavily into the grain industry in grain shipments, BNSF alone spent $15 billion over the past 3 years to better link with ports, including 1,000 miles of double track and high-speed loaders. So in the U.S., there's an incentive and cooperation between railways to invest in their system to get the grain moving, and because by doing that, what you're going to do is you're going to have quick turnaround and good use, good efficient use of equipment. In Canada, that incentive is absent, and there's a real difference between the two systems, and we're the poorer in Canada for our system.
Well, if I may, I think probably, and I don't know the numbers, but I'm sure CN and CP would argue that in their Canadian operations, they too are investing in developing the system.
Yeah, they have invested. They've made really good investments in the system, but they can't, for example, just if you look at the hopper cars, there is an example of a major infrastructure investment that has to be made, regulation is holding it back. There's about 17,000 cars needed for an entire new fleet, and the cost is being, I'm giving you a ballpark figure here, of $2 billion, there is some real disincentive for the railways to invest to make these new capacity enhancing, efficiency enhancing purchases, and so that's the difference. When you've got a regulated system as we have here, there's a disincentive for some infrastructure investment, and hopper cars is a perfect example. Railways are definitely keeping up on their track and making sure that they're safe, but I noticed that Hunter Harrison, in a letter recently to the Ministers of Transportation and Agriculture, had said, if you want your system to operate efficiently, you need investment, connectedness, and transparency through contracts. Those three things, once you have those in place, you're going to have a first-class grain transportation system. We don't have that.
Hunter Harrison of CN, correct? That's
CT.
Your region? Or CT, I mean, yes.
Yeah.
All right, so as far as disincentives, then, maybe could you just elaborate a bit on that? Are you talking about this maximum rate or maximum earnings entitlement?
That's what I'm referring to. So the maximum revenue entitlement, what it does is it provides a cap on how much the railways can earn each year on grain shipments, grain transportation, and it is a mathematical formula, and it doesn't give sufficient incentive within the formula for the railways to make new hopper car purchases. And I know that a recent article by Kevin Hirsch, He brought out three serious disincentives. He said that, first of all, everyone in the industry knows about the free rider aspect to the on the revenue cap. That is that an investment made by CN benefits CP as well. So that's called the free rider issue. And the recent Transportation Review, David Emerson called that an investment disincentive. So it's well known. There's one example, well known across the board, as that is disincentives investment in the system. And then Kevin Hirsch uncovered a couple others, that the revenue cap only allows lease and purchase expenses relative to the government cars that have been destroyed or eliminated. And the third one would be that the revenue cap formula, the MRE as you call it, people call it by either name, but it only discounts a portion of the lease cost, and it's minimal and unrepresentative of cost. So there you've got three reasons why you've got railways, and there are more, not interested in investing in that kind of major rolling stock purchase. And as long as you don't have that new kind of rolling stock purchase, what you're going to have is an inefficient system, unlike the United States, where there will be investment in, for example, BNSF that I spoke of earlier. Jack has completely replenished their over the past 10 years, their hopper car fleet. So that's the differences between the two systems. Ours is the poorer, as I say.
Well, I guess, so that was a discussion with transportation consultant Mary Jane Bennett. She's a senior fellow with the Frontier Center for Public Policy. That's based in Winnipeg. Mary Jane lives in Vancouver. She's a lawyer and transportation consultant. Now, the references to the meeting just breaking up here, you might hear some background noise. The reference Mary Jane Bennett was making
to Kevin Hirsch was a recent article in the Western Producer called "A Just Rail Revenue Cap to Encourage Investment," was what she was referring to there. And as you heard earlier from Kevin, as he addressed this public information meeting we've attended in Regina this morning, the first of a series of meetings about a multi-purpose terminal concept for the Weyburn area under a group called Comtrax. Well, 2016 flax production was down almost 40% this year, the result of a near 50% drop in flax acres. And, of course, that is tied to the fact that flax prices have definitely been depressed in recent years. Stats Canada this week confirmed, though, a record canola and lentil production in Saskatchewan, and 41 bushels per acre cranked out over 9.8 million tons of Saskatchewan canola, also a new record. Lentils were a record acreage this year, although yield and quality did suffer with our extended and was it an unusual fall? I'm not sure. Harvested wheat area dropped over 12% from a year ago. Harvested acres dropped by about 20%, but oat averages now are about 94 bushels per acre. And incidentally, that was one of the discussions at this terminal feasibility meeting, which we attended this morning in Regina, the fact that yields of virtually all the crops have come up drastically. In the catchment area of this proposed terminal we've been talking about from the Weyburn area, it's now estimated that in the last 15 years, production on average is up by about a million metric tons, so that's significant. Now, mustard output jumped of an amazing 76% this year, according to the StatCan's number. Soybeans continued to gain acres and also came up with a 32 bushel per acre yield, although harvested acres were down 13%. So again, for further insight, we turn to Kevin Hirsch, who farms in Westside, Saskatchewan, one of the presenters today. And just prior to today's terminal information meetings in Regina, Kevin was attending a special crops roundtable in Winnipeg.
And you're part of the specialty crops group. I know you grow lentils and chickpeas and some of those crops we consider specialty crops. In the context of what Stats Canada showed us this week, I guess maybe a lot of people were surprised overall that there was as much production as there was, given the weather and all the rest of it. But just your comments there, if you would.
The special crops certainly are up and down. I wasn't surprised to see the chickpea yields way down. That was my experience, where chickpeas really didn't do well in the wet weather, terrible quality, many abandoned fields, a lot of problems with that crop. Canary seed production was down. It's interesting to note, too, if you look at the last Sask Ag crop report, canary seed has the highest percentage of the crop still remaining in the field in Saskatchewan. Something like 17 or 18% is still unharvested. And a couple of reasons for that is that canary seed does weather winter better than some other crops will, and oftentimes producers leave it to the last for that reason. And a lot of the canary seed is in west central Saskatchewan that has the biggest percentage of unharvested land. But canary seed production was down. Mustard production was up, a tribute to the acres. Lentil acreage was way up, and production was way up, and that was certainly as expected too. It'll be interesting to see what happens in 2017, because lentils still on paper look like a very attractive option, but a lot of producers had serious issues with the root rot, and I sense that some will be trying to go some other directions with their cropping plans. But those same areas that grow lentils often grow durum wheat, and durum wheat had tremendous fusarium issues. So producers are in many of the southern areas that are traditionally drier parts of Saskatchewan are facing quite a quandary to know just what to go with for crops, you know, when you look at the experience in 2016.
You're the exec with the Mustard Association. Huge jump in production there, and I guess that was as you expected?
Yes. I think it was expected because contract prices a year ago at this time for mustard were very good. And mustard is a crop that has a high percentage of producers that forward contract with act of God clauses in their contract. So it looked like a really good stable option. Now, I expect the opposite to happen in 2017, because if you look at new crop contract prices, particularly for yellow mustard, which is the dominant class of mustard we grow, those are historically low right now. You could maybe get, you know, somewhere in the range perhaps of 32 cents a pound for a new crop yellow mustard contract, and that's nowhere near what producers would consider attractive for that crop. But prices tend to go up and down, and with production, we're a major world exporter, so what we produce here has a big effect on world prices, and with production up, prices have dropped back, and I expect that cycle to repeat, that the now acres will drop back, and a year from now, we might be, again, looking at some attractive prices if the inventory can be whittled down. But those crops where we greatly affect the world price, we can sometimes be on an up-and-down roller coaster.
All right. A great discussion all around. Kevin Hirsch, we appreciate your comments. We'll look forward to talking more to you following this round of meetings with the Terminal Group.
So, yes, and you heard from Kevin Hirsch earlier, the Terminal Group looking to connect with farmers and the industries into I'm going to call it a whole new concept of moving grain as well as oil and other commodities. They're called Comtracts, Comtracts Logistics, and they have a website which you can easily Google. Now, in a related matter to these increased grain production in Canada, a U.S.-based ag economy group says it perceives that American farmers have received a boost of confidence from a rally in crop prices, especially for soybeans, of course, huge in the United States. That, combined once again with record yields this fall, has the Purdue University Ag Economy Barometer pushed to a high point not seen in over a year. And you might be saying, what barometer is that? Well, Purdue University has been putting out this measurement of the economy, the ag economy, for some time now. It's simply a measurement index. You can find it online at Purdue.com/CME Group Ag Economy Barometer, or probably if you just Googled Purdue Barometer, you'd likely find it. Interesting sidelight. Other things going on in the agriculture world, of course. This is that time of year for meetings and annual meetings, and then we get into the producer seminars such as Crop Week, which comes up early in the new year. Well, the man who led APAS, Saskatchewan's General Farm Group, has stepped aside, but Norm Hall of Wynyard remains on the APAS Board of Directors as a vice president. The new president is Todd Lewis of Gray, just southeast of Regina.
The goal still remains the same, you know, for our organization and myself personally, to be a good voice for Saskatchewan agriculture and, you know, to lobby on behalf of producers right across Saskatchewan and be a good voice provincially, you know, municipally and nationally. And I think it's always been APAS's goal, and hopefully we continue to expand that work, and there doesn't seem to be any shortage of issues.
Todd Lewis confirms that APAS members aren't among the federal carbon tax plan favorites.
Well, certainly the carbon at our convention here is, you know, pretty high on the agenda now. It's something that's certainly come up very quickly, and we always knew it was kind of in the background, but some of the announcements and so on that have come this fall, it's certainly at the top of the list now as far as something that is fairly immediate, and there's not a very long timeline in front of us to get some stuff in place. So I think that's probably number one priority, and probably 1A would still be the transportation issue. It's certainly some other announcements there this fall, again, that Minister Garneau made and so on, who talked about new legislation and everything, so we sure want to be at the table to talk about. They said they're going to consult with the prairie groups and so on as far as what should be in the legislation and what we'd like to see, and we'll be at the table there for that as well. And hopefully the federal government does some good work on that file.
And of course, on that question, Premier Wall and other Canadian premiers are to be meeting with the federal, with the Prime Minister regarding some of those carbon tax and related issues. Now, in our earlier interview with transportation analyst Mary Jane Bennett, we discussed the fact that farm groups are eager to keep the MRE, the maximum rate entitlement. APAS is supporting the imposition of a maximum revenue provision on the railway.
area?
The protection of the MRE, and that we've been told it's going to remain. Certainly a costing review is something that's still on the table, but realize that some of the, it's maybe on the back burner a little bit, but certainly still in the front of our minds that we get that corrected and continue working under the protection of the MRE. I think certainly the inter-switching rules and so on are big for big piece of that. We can continue to see the expanded inter-switching. That seems to have helped quite a bit. The grain companies are saying that that certainly helped their positions and getting trains and the right train at the right time, of course. And I think certainly the reciprocal penalties and so on are all a big part of it as well. So I think everything that they've promised to give us, and let's hope they can get it in a good legislation, and it should be better for all shippers in Western Canada, not just grain.
Again, these are comments from the now incoming president of APAS, Todd Lewis of Gray, as of just a week or so ago, as the APAS people held their annual meeting. Lewis appeared somewhat satisfied with answers given about covering at least some farmer losses from this year's harvest.
They came and talked to us, presented, the head of crop insurance was there, and Minister Stewart as well, and they've given every signal that they want farmers to contact them. There's lots of crops still out in the field, and they sound that they're willing to look at individual cases and so on, and do what they can to do as help and grading factors, and it's going to be a long winter for a lot of producers, and we are assured that crop insurance is going to try and do their best to try and get some cash in people's hands in the cases where they can. And so I think that's something that we'll certainly keep a close eye on, and we'll hear lots about over the winter months. And of course, drainage is never far off of anybody's minds, as wet as we are going into the winter here and so on. And if we have any amount of snowfall and a quick melt in the spring, we're certainly going to have some water running in every direction again this next spring. So we're hoping for a little bit of dry weather this winter, but Mother Nature hasn't really been dealing with that for quite a number of winters here. Maybe last winter was a little bit drier, but 3 feet of snow and a hot week in April, we're going to have some issues again this spring, I think. So drainage is always top of mind in this wet cycle that we're in right now.
But again, Todd Lewis, newly selected APAS president. Now, members of the Saskatchewan Farm Stewardship Association got a close-up look at one of the major areas of water concern recently, the Quill Lakes, and will continue to follow their concerns about new legislation and what's happening on the water frontage on upcoming programs on the land. Well, we've been live again today in Regina for the first of a series of public information meetings regarding a new terminal project in the Weyburn area. And thanks, Scott Fitzsimmons, our producer, for getting us cranked through this, and the members of this this group that we're attending here in Regina, the Contracts Terminal Group, most hospitable. On the land, from The Rock, I'm Jack Doyle.
Thanks for listening to All You Ever Wanted to Know. If you or your organization would like to appear on the program, call Jordan at 306-786-7625. All You Ever Wanted to Know, only on The Rock 98.5.